Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Interpreter Insights Podcast. I'm Terry Hutchinson. My special guest today is going to be John Gee, and we're going to be talking about a topic that he and I have been discussing off-air for many years. But first, we want to talk about the mission of the Interpreter Foundation, which is to support the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints through scholarship. We make the latest and best scholarship available to you in podcasts, journal articles, books, seminars, films, and scripture roundtables. We invite you to see what Interpreter has to offer at interpreterfoundation.org. Because the Interpreter Foundation is not owned or controlled by the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the comments we make are solely our responsibility. Now, I want to welcome John back to the program.
Thank you.
You really don't need any introduction for this podcast because you were just on a couple of months ago, and you've been a frequent contributor as well as a co-host for many years. But I wanted, before we begin our topic, which is your Interpreter Journal article, it's a book review that was just published, I want to say Friday the
24th.
Oh, happy Pioneer Day.
And
it's a great article. I was really looking forward to it, and I really enjoyed it. But this podcast is going to be broadcast on the 30th of July, which is a week before the FAIR Conference, which is going to be held at Thanksgiving Point in Utah County. That's Lehigh. John, you're speaking there. Tell us a little bit about, you're talking with John Thompson about the Book of Abraham, and I don't think you're speaking as a panel. I think he speaks and then you speak.
He's speaking and he's got his topic, and it was only a couple of weeks ago that I found out that he was speaking.
Yeah. So well, that's the way it works.
It's going to be a joy to be with John Thompson. I've known him for many years. He does good, solid work.
Sorry, John. Let me interrupt. This is going to be Thursday morning. I want to say about 11 o'clock. John Thompson speaks at 11. You speak about 11:30, 11:45.
Something like that.
And your topic, tell us a little about it and give us a preview, if you would.
Well, they asked me to talk about the Book of Abraham, and I'm happy to do that. And I was going to give a status report, so what has happened in the last, say, 6 to 10 years. But I only had 20 minutes. So you can't really talk about everything. So I've narrowed it down. I'm just going to talk about the translation of the Book of Abraham. That seems to be the thing that everybody has problems with, or claims that they have problems with. And people who followed Interpreter, if you want a preview of what I'm going to say, it'll be streamlined and not as into the weeds. But I published a couple of articles, and I'm going to slim it down and basically show that there are about four or five historical anchor points, and any theory that you propose about the translation needs to hit those anchor points. Otherwise, you're not dealing with history. And that's what I'll be doing.
All right. And I can tell you that I know that John Thompson completed recently a book on Abraham with Jeff Bradshaw, published by the Interpreter, which is a phenomenal commentary on the parts of Genesis that cover the Abraham story. But they were going to try and do some commentary on the Book of Abraham. Didn't quite fit in the book, and I know that that's a project John's working on.
It's interesting because Stephen Smoot just published a commentary on the Book of Abraham.
Uh-huh, yeah.
It's something that I've thought ought to be done, but I'm glad I'm not the one doing it.
That would be quite a challenge.
You know, I'm supposedly working on this commentary on something else. And
well, it's already announced. You can say what it is.
I'm supposedly working on this commentary on James for the BYU New Testament commentary.
Yeah, whenever I'm at BYU Studies, by the way, they ask me to remind you to work on it.
Well, yes. And I do occasionally work on it. It's
a long-term project.
It has been a long-term project, and I'm hopefully providing something that will be interesting to read. But it's always a problem when you're dealing with this sort of thing to come up with something that is hopefully worth the time to read.
Yeah.
Or to look at. So I realized commentaries, people go and they look up passages because they're not interested in slogging their way through the whole thing. But the author has to slog their way through the whole thing. And hopefully provide, so you want to provide a resource where people aren't going to systematically read it. They're going to look up the passage that they're interested in, they're going to read it. And so you need to write it in such a way that it doesn't require them to have already, if you're just looking up, for example, something out of chapter two, it doesn't require that you have read chapter one in order to understand what's being talked about in chapter two. And I'm trying to ground it in primary sources. And so that also takes some time. And I've been sidetracked. And I should just say no to all of these things. But people say, can you do something on X? And so I'll go do something on X for them. But I think this may have been what kept Nibley's One Eternal Round from being finished by him. Is that people kept asking him to talk about something else.
Well, he also, near the end, had a big project for the first presidency in the 12 that he worked on for a long time. So
yeah, well, yeah, he had lots of...
Lots of those kind of projects.
Projects. And so you do what you can, and you just hope that you have the wisdom and are blessed by the Lord to be able to finish it.
On Friday, you published a book with interpreter, a book review, I should say, called Theology as Pretext. And it's a review of a couple of books by Ben Witherington III, who's not LDS. And in the abstract, you say he outlines a method for interpreting the Bible, emphasizes studying the Bible in the original languages and original contexts without imposing foreign philosophies or frameworks, and focuses on the ethical teachings of the Bible. And then you talk about how his method undermines his own project, and in this, there are lessons that we can take as Latter-day Saints. There's a citation that you have in footnote number 59 where you quote yourself, and this is something that I've talked about. It's in volume 2 of The Interpreter. It's one of the earliest interpreter articles that was there, and it was something that I really focused on at the time. It's called The Apocryphal Acts of Jesus. But in that article, it was fascinating to me because you talk in that about the fact that this article has a history. And you mentioned kind of what that history was, that it had floated around for a long time. The places where it was originally going to land and be published weren't able to publish it for various reasons. One was technical.
You know, some articles are straightforward. You have a venue in mind, you sit down, you write it, and it publishes. So the one that absolutely astounded me is I was at a conference talking with a colleague about a particular problem, and then said, well, would you like to publish it with me? And he said, yes. And I went home, or went back to the hotel. You got a few hours before bedtime, and I pounded the thing out, the first draft that night, sent it to him. In 2 weeks, and this has never happened before, in 2 weeks, we'd written the article, submitted it, and had it accepted for publication within 2 weeks of saying, let's write this article. Now, that sort of thing doesn't normally happen.
Yeah, I was going to say.
But it can. Sometimes you just sit down and you write it, and everything goes smoothly. And other times, there's a long and sometimes torturous path. The one I usually cite is an example of one that I wrote the article, and we were expecting our first children at the time. And that is in the background to me when I wrote the article, and there's some things that are reflected in the article about that, although you'd have to know what it was to even spot it. But by the time that got published, my daughter, who we were expecting when we wrote it, had finished her mission and was almost done with college.
That's the way it works.
And there's a long history of what happened behind the scenes, why it took 23 years to get it in print. And things like this happen. Sometimes there are these stories. And this, the Apocryphal Acts of Jesus, was one of those where it took about 15 years, and then interpreter came around, and colleagues who'd seen it said, yes, you ought to publish this, but for various reasons, it didn't get into press. And I've had a number of those that have.
I would encourage the listeners to go to volume 2 and look up John's article. right before the footnotes, which are extensive. And it's a great article. You should read the whole thing. It's fascinating about some of these comments about Jesus and the 40-day ministry and how we have to be very careful and pay attention to where they come from and how much weight we might want to give them in our personal study. But there's a section on exactly the various venues where this article was going to go and then why it didn't go forward. It's not like, oh yeah, Interpreter just publishes anything. Because as a matter of fact, John, you've had things that have not been accepted by Interpreter.
Oh yeah. I mean, I have colleagues who are about ready to retire is the first time they get an article turned down. I've had plenty of articles turned down. Most recent one in a non-LDS venue turned it down because I was too favorable towards religion in general. And I wasn't even talking about ours. They get turned down for, I've had articles turned down because I'm a Latter-day Saint. I've had articles turned down because I spoke favorably of religion. I've had articles turned down because we don't talk about this topic. Or we only talk about one side of this topic. There's a lot of that in academia where you can talk about a topic, but only if you toe the line, even if you've got the evidence to say, yeah, we don't want to maybe parrot this part of the theory. You can't do that.
So anyway, getting to that, you and I have been talking about various aspects of theology for years off the air. And we've been tracking some of the publications and some of the ideas and so forth. And so you finally were able to address this in this review about Ben Witherington's books. So why don't you tell us a little about those?
So the Ben Witherington's book, you know, I'm vaguely aware of Ben Witherington. And then he came out with this book in 2005. And I remember seeing it and saying, this sounds interesting. And the book was called The Problem with Evangelical Theology. And, you know, it's a great book. And some of it can be tough slogging because it's talking about specific problems in evangelical theology. So if you're not used to those sorts of arguments, it can be a little bit tough. But he makes a lot of really good points. And I'd been vaguely aware of him, but this definitely put him on my radar. And he lays it out. He has a good writing style. And he's able to explain things well and explain things clearly. But I didn't particularly do anything with it at the time. And then he came out with this book this year called Rethinking Biblical and Systematic Theology. And one of the editors and interpreters suggested that I review it. So I reviewed it and I noticed that he's going over the same ground in many ways. And with the earlier book, is dealing specifically with this systematic theology and how oftentimes it isn't biblical. But he's using his method hasn't changed in the meantime. But the method is the same one that I've been using for years and Nibley used. And so it's very interesting to see it applied to this specific discipline. I've never met Ben Witherington, but I'm impressed with his work. And as I say, I really like his approach. So his approach is, first, you need to read the original languages. We believe the Bible, as far as it's translated correctly, how do you tell if it's translated correctly? If you're a scholar, you check it against the original languages, which means you have to learn them. And then he talks about using the original context, which also is something that has long been ingrained in me, and I like putting things in context. And then he talked about it in this book, which he didn't really talk about as much in the first one, about what happens when you impose foreign philosophies or frameworks, and how he noted theologians tend to ignore ethical teachings. And I'd read another book earlier this year, which mentions ethics and theology from a different angle, which I thought was useful. But the problem with this is, if you know something about the history of theology, years ago, Lou Midgley published a number of articles on the context and the history of theology. I had a slightly different take, and part of it comes out of working on that article on the Apocryphal Acts of Jesus, where I went through all of these apocryphal materials. And you look through the Nag Hammadi Library, which, because I teach Coptic, that comes up every 2 years, at least. And for many people, Coptic literature is the Nag Hammadi Library. Now, that's a really narrow slice of Coptic literature, and fortunately I had some broader base on that. But it got me thinking about what theology was before and how it got introduced to Christianity. So that was some of the newer research I put in. Theology originally had nothing to do with Christianity or with Judaism. It comes from the Greeks, and it was a fully developed branch of their studies. It was part of philosophy. This didn't end up in here, but I'd also done some research on how theology was introduced into the ancient Egyptian religion. And I didn't put it in here, but it is introduced, and within 50 years, the whole thing is dead.
The whole religion or the whole idea of theology in Egyptian?
No, the whole religion. Theology seemed to have killed it off. Yeah, it's really interesting on the timeline, because I spend all this time doing Egyptology and then finally read one of the classic works that was known before that, which is Amblicus on the Mysteries, which is all dealing with an attempt to view Egyptian religion through a theological lens. And it was a fascinating read because I could recognize the pieces and how they'd been completely rearranged into things that were very un-Egyptian. But I could see, oh, I recognize this term. These are the Egyptian equivalents of these terms. And here's how he's reinterpreting them to match Greek philosophical ideas. And one of which is that God doesn't have a body. There's nothing corporeal about them, which is when you've got an image of the god that's gold-plated, that's sitting in the sanctuary. That's a very, to say, well, God really doesn't have a body, when every day the priests are taking the body out, feeding it and washing it and clothing it and returning it to the shrine. That's a big contradiction to what their interpretation is. And that isn't the only thing that killed it off. There's a Roman decree that helped a lot, but between those two things, within 50 years, we can't find traces of it, except at Philae. And at Philae, it's all Nubians who come up, who don't live in the Roman Empire, who come up and celebrate this festival once a year and leave their graffiti, and they're the ones preserving it because they're not under the Roman edict. And the Romans aren't doing anything about it for a couple hundred years because they don't want to start a war. They've got enough wars as it is. I want to start another one. So theology doesn't necessarily have the best reputation, and we mention a couple of episodes of that in the review. So theology in Jesus's time is something that's completely pagan. It doesn't show up in the New Testament, either mentioned or as a topic. It would not have been relevant to any of the Christians in the first century when they're writing the New Testament. It would be a little bit like, you don't have any mention of amoebas in the Bible, but why would you? And it's just not on their radar. And then to have that completely take over later, it's a Greek philosophical framework for making texts read the way you want to read it. And in Ben Witherington's word, it says, text without a context is simply a pretext for whatever the interpreter wishes it to mean.
Well, and in your review, you mentioned that Witherington is a bit critical of what we call a reader-centered theology.
Yes, he is.
What does he mean by that?
In looking at systematic theology, he critiques a number of things where later philosophical movements have come in and tried to impose themselves on the Bible. He mentions Kantian readings, and then he is critical of intertextuality readings, postmodernisms. He says, all later forms of theologizing, including contemporary theologies such as post-colonial theology, philosophical theology, or historical theology, and much more, must be tested against and normed by the Bible, not the least because these later constructs were not inspired directly by God. And he compares them to a Rorschach test.
Says that it's the biblical text is not an inkblot test.
Right, like it's not an inkblot test, yeah. But he compares them to that, where people just, here's the old psychology Rorschach test, where here's this splattering of ink on this. What do you see when you look at this? And he says the Bible shouldn't be read that way. It's not, doesn't, it meant what the ancient authors meant it to mean, not what, and we shouldn't use our theology to make it mean what we want to mean. So the problem with a reader-centered theology is that the theologians who do that use that because they want it to sort of free associate and have it mean whatever they want it to mean instead of what the original authors meant it to mean. So it's the sort of thing where we believe that Jesus was the Son of God and that what he spoke was the truth and that he taught certain things that we ought to influence how we think and how we act. And what can happen with theology, and Witherington has lots of examples of this, is people ignore whatever the text meant at the time and proof text it to say what they want to do and what they want to think rather than what Jesus wanted them to do and think. And that's essentially can be the problem with theology, particularly in Protestantism. And Witherington has lots and lots of examples.
You quote a guy named Ronald Sider.
Yes.
I don't know that Witherington quotes him, but
No,
you
Witherington doesn't quote him. It's
this
just
was
that
the book you
Ronald's.
found, right?
Yeah,
That
so there's a little history here. So about 25 years ago, Mark Knoll wrote this book called The Scandal of the Evangelical Mind. And he is a
Isn't
historian.
that Sider who wrote The
No.
Scandal of the Evangelical Conscience, or is this a
All right, no,
different
but
guy?
it's Mark Knoll wrote first The Scandal of the Evangelical
Oh,
Mind.
okay. Okay.
And he says the problem with we evangelicals is we have all these universities and we actually don't produce anybody who thinks, or we don't produce enough people who are any good as scholars. And then about 5 years after that, and it's the same time that Witherington's writing his first book, Ron Sider comes out with The Scandal of the Evangelical Conscience, where he is directly playing off Mark Knoll. But he says the real problem is not that we don't produce good intellectuals, but that we don't produce good people, that we don't seem to have a conscience, that evangelicals are as bad as the rest of the world that we think that we're different from and better than. And this feeds in, of course, to Witherington's discussion of ethics, because ethics is how you behave. And if evangelicals are having problems with their behavior, Witherington links that to their theology, is that they're not paying attention to the ethic. What sort of effect does that have on how people behave? Are
What
they
are the
actually behaving
fruits?
like
We can just say they're fruits, right? Where are
Right.
the
Well, it's
fruits?
yeah. We can talk about it as the fruits, and Jesus' parable is accurate there. And I do have another interpreter article on this passage, where by their fruits you shall know them, and that's part of beware of false prophets who come into you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly are ravening wolves. So, but you know them by their fruits. And so, what you Witherington says is there's a connection between the theology that we're doing in the ethics, and we need to pay more attention to the ethics. And Sider is going saying, yeah, we're ethically, we're not much different, and in some cases worse than the world on the things that we're supposed to be better at. Then you've got another book, which I cite in here, Christian Smith's Why Religion Went Obsolete, where he argues that it's precisely that the behavior isn't there, that people see the hypocrisy in Christians, and particularly among Christian leaderships in Protestantism and Catholicism. And that's one of the reasons why people are leaving religion. They see the fruits and they say, yeah, this is not right. So all of these are interconnected. And so I also bring in Eliza Griswold.
Well, this is inspired by her father.
Well, no, well, it's inspired by her father, but there's this project that shows up in people who do sociology and religion, and because most of the people who do religious studies, sociology, religion, have themselves a particular political and philosophical mindset about how they want to live life and think that this is the best for all people. And so, in sociology, for example, they like the idea of cohabitation. They think that this is a great thing, and that everybody ought to do it because this is really good. But one of the most replicated facets of sociology is that this is terrible. This is awful for the lives of people. You're more likely to get divorced if you cohabit before marriage than you do If you don't, that gets replicated time and time again. Now, they want to cohabit before marriage, and so they think it's a good thing. And that's one of the reasons they keep redoing the study is, oh, things must have improved in the meantime. So they want a religion that would teach those sorts of things. And religions that teach that sort of things go downhill really quickly. You can see this in mainline Protestantism and other places, but they want to see one of those flourishing. So Eliza Griswold, they found this church in Philadelphia that looked like it was flourishing and looked like it taught the right things. So she embedded herself into this community and went to the pastor meetings, went around with the pastors and wanted to chronicle all the things that they were doing and see this actually works. And the whole thing fell apart while she was doing it. And so instead she chronicles how all of this just disintegrated. To me, what was interesting reading through that is that she mentions by name all the theology books that these people were reading. And she chronicles how the theology books changed their opinions from where what they once thought was good, they came to think of as evil, and what they once thought was evil, they came to think of as good.
And she did that by focusing on the pastors who were teaching the congregation.
Right. She was focusing on the pastors and all of this, and she mentions their reading, and it's just all through the book. And you look at that footnote and the number of passages where she's mentioning, oh, he read this and he read that, or in some of the cases of the pastors, she read this, and they talk about what influences, and I'm not going to go through all of that. I'm not that interested. What is interesting is she shows how the pastor's opinions and perspectives completely shifted, all by reading theology, which is supposedly based on the Bible. She provides a good example of how theology internalized can make a big difference. I thought that was interesting how it changed the ethics. Witherington is interested in theologians dealing with ethics. I'm interested for a different reason, but it's interesting that we both think that there should be some emphasis on ethics and what the consequences of the teachings are. And of course, that and the passage you mentioned, that goes back to Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount.
The final section of your article, which I recommend the listeners go to, is all about how really Witherington doesn't quite take his ideas far enough, or his project far enough.
If we're going to read it in the original context,
right,
and we don't want to introduce non-Christian philosophical frameworks, theology is a non-Christian philosophical framework. And so that sort of undermines his project. And as you read them, at least from that perspective, you can see that he recognizes some of that, but he still doesn't see theology as a problem. And I've liked some of Witherington's stuff. I am all for using the method that he lays out, or key parts of it. It's the one I use. But I think it does undercut, in the end, his project, because if you're really doing that, if you're really trying to avoid bringing in these pagan philosophical frameworks, then theology is one of those. I thought it was important to lay out that perspective, and I don't think that that will dissuade Witherington, and I don't really care what Witherington thinks about this sort of stuff. Yeah. I hope he continues to produce good work.
Well, you say at the end of the section, this last section, not the conclusion, but you say, as Witherington urges us, we should reject Greek philosophy and external frameworks. Why should we use theology, a Greek philosophical framework, to understand the Bible or the gospel of Jesus Christ? And essentially, you bring that up in the conclusion.
Yeah.
You quote President Kimball for something called a gospel methodology.
At BYU for the last, about 5 years, leading up to the 150th sesquicentennial of BYU, they've gone back to President Kimball's second century address, and they've talked about wanting to use gospel methodology. And I'm all for that. But they've tried to figure out what it was that President Kimball meant by that. But President Kimball sent down the Church Commissioner of Education, gave 4 published talks at BYU, wrote 1 book and 1 Ensign article, all dealing with this. So we have an outline of what sort of gospel methodology is. And one of those quotes from the book talks about how Latter-day Saint scholars should be able to read firsthand ancient texts. which is what Witherington is arguing. So we have prophetic counsel to follow at least portions of Witherington's methodology. It's explained eloquently there, but I quote that and we'll let the listeners go to that. You know, Witherington talks about how you shouldn't be able to have theologians should not be able to go through Christian schools without knowing anything about Greek or Hebrew or the ancient context of the Bible. And I agree with that. And it was Nibley's method. And I realize that not everybody can do that. And even those who don't do that don't always do it well. I try to tell my students, you need to not only know the languages, you need to know them well, because there are lots of people who know just enough of the language to be a danger to themselves and everyone around them. And that requires a bit of effort. And again, not everybody can do that. Not everybody needs to do that. But if you're going to put yourself forward as a scholar, you owe it to yourself, if not your readers or your listeners, to know them as well as you can. Everybody doesn't need to be a scholar. I don't think that that's a wise course of action either. We need all kinds of people with all kinds of skills and all kinds of abilities in the church to help build the kingdom. And we can't do it all ourselves. It's just that you have different skills that are useful and necessary. And Brigham Young talked about bringing all of this into Zion, the people who can do it well. There may be some things against the commandment we don't need in Zion, but most honest professions are something that we need, and in the right measure. Mm-hmm. Not everybody needs to be a hand, not everybody needs to be a foot in order for the body to function. But you do need to have some hands and some feet.
Absolutely. John, I want to thank you for being with us to share these ideas. Let me just sum up. Your last paragraph really sums up your philosophy, if you would, about theology.
Yeah. Let's do the whole thing.
Okay, do the whole thing.
Theology was not condoned by Jesus or the writers of the New Testament. It was a pagan philosophical interpretive framework imposed onto Christianity, used from the very beginning to make the text mean whatever the theologian wants it to mean. As such, it has always been a parasite on the body of Christ. It is precisely because I use a methodology that is similar to Witherington's that I utterly reject theology.
Yeah. You can't be more plain than that. And that really, John, sums up discussions that you and I have been having for almost 10 years now.
Has it been that long?
It has. I can't tell you, John, how much I really appreciated the article, following the logic, learning about the ancient applications and origins of theology. And I encourage the listeners to go back and take a look at it. It's not overly technical. The one big foreign language phrase that you use, it's Latin. Is in a footnote. You can ignore it because you give us the translation.
Well, it's just because the Latin was so hard to find, included the whole thing in the footnote. But it's a great story.
Uh-huh. But this is an article that really puts things in proper perspective about this practice. And it's something that we as Latter-day Saints need to be aware of, because it's something that we deal with in the modern world. So yeah. I want to thank you for being with us, John. I appreciate it. Good luck on your fair presentation next week, and I'm sure we'll have you on again. And since you don't have very much to talk about Abraham studies other than the small sliver that you're going to be able to cover at fair, we'll have you on again in a couple of months, and we'll do a much more broad survey of what's been going on.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, John. And thank you, listeners. Join us again for another edition of Interpreter Insights at a future time.